administration already frustrated over major clean energy legislation that has stalled in Congress due to the opposition from Republicans as well as centrist Democrats such as West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin. Judith Enck, former Environmental Protection Agency regional administrator and president of Beyond Plastics, said, "This is a vitally important case that will define future federal action on climate change issues." Judith Enck added, "Congress seems unwilling or unable to address the climate crisis. Federal agencies need to be able to take action." Even if Joe Biden and his allies in U.S. Congress are able to pass the climate elements of the Build Back Better Act, which includes hundreds of billions of dollars in support for wind and solar energy, as well as electric cars, most analysts say executive action to slash pollution from power plants, cars and trucks will still be needed if the United States is to meet its emissions reduction goals and avert disastrous climate change. West Virginia's lawsuit, filed last year and supported by various fossil fuel firms and right-wing groups, argues that the Environmental Protection Agency shouldn't be able to issue rules that are capable of reshaping the nation's electricity grids and unilaterally decarbonizing virtually any sector of the economy, and claims that Congress alone should decide on regulation of this scope. Patrick Morrissey, Attorney General of West Virginia, a state that's a traditional epicenter of the now ailing coal industry, said, "This case is much more than about climate change. It gets down to who makes the decisions. Should it be an unelected body of bureaucrats, or should Congress provide the clear signal?" The Biden administration has pointed out there is no current Environmental Protection Agency climate regulation on coal plants, meaning that there is no case to argue at all. The Biden administration has argued in its brief, petitioners lack standing to invoke the court's jurisdiction because they're not injured. According to Richard Rebesh, a leading expert in environmental law at New York University School of Law, it's unusual for the Supreme Court to hear a case where there is no active rule to challenge. He said, "It surprised me they took this case. This would be an excellent candidate for dismissal." Richard Rebesh added, "In normal times, when the court wasn't so skeptical of regulation, this case wouldn't have been dismissed. It would have a pernicious consequence if it were allowed, because it could severely restrict agencies' ability to regulate, and these power stations are such big emitters." The case has a tangled history that highlights America's jarring absence of any climate regulations on the U.S. electricity sector, which is responsible for a quarter of the country's emissions, even as it has set emission standards for the pollution spewed out by cars and trucks. In 2015, Barack Obama's administration sought to remedy this via the Clean Power Plan, which aimed to restrict emissions from coal-fired power plants, only to be immediately challenged by Republican-led states, and in a highly unusual move, blocked by the Supreme Court before it took effect. Donald Trump's administration then crafted a far weaker replacement for this rule that was itself struck down by the courts of law, with Biden so far declining to resurrect the original Clean Power Plan or any more stringent alternative in its place. West Virginia and its allies hope to curtail any future attempt by the Environmental Protection Agency to become far more assertive in its interpretation of the landmark Clean Air Act, which requires power plants to use the best system of emission reduction. Environmental groups, which have lined up to oppose West Virginia's claims, worry that the case is a further example of a right-wing judicial system intervening to toss out rules it does not like, with the justification that they are too large, with damaging consequences for the climate crisis. Earlier this month, A Trump-appointed federal judge in Louisiana blocked the Biden administration from accounting for the real-world costs of climate change. Sean Donohue, counsel for Environmental Defense Fund, said, "Even though there is no rule in place, the case is important because coal companies and their allies are attempting to get the Supreme Court to establish a broad precedent that meaningful protections for public health and the environment should be scrutinized and discredited on judicial review." Sean Donohue added, "Petitioners' damaging legal theory would threaten our nation's ability to protect clean air, clean water, and safe food for all the people." To some onlookers, the case is an unwanted further complication to a challenge that already has little time to waste. Carol Browner, former administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency and now chair of the League of Conservation Voters, said, "There is no more time to delay curbing greenhouse gas emissions and finding solutions for a more equitable and just clean energy future."
According to the United States, Vladimir Putin should have invaded Ukraine by now several times. For the past weeks, we've heard nothing but hysteria from Western officials and media, claiming that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is imminent. So where is it? Now, officially, Ukraine is not a member of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Nevertheless, it does enjoy considerable NATO support. The U.S., U.K., and others have said that they are ready to stand firm with Ukraine and help it face Russian aggression. Other countries, like France and Germany, have sought a softer, nuanced approach, preferring diplomacy with Russia over sending weapons to Ukraine. So what is happening between Russia and Ukraine? Is Putin really going to invade? Multiple Russian officials, including the president, have said no, Russia will not invade Ukraine. On the other hand, U.S. intelligence has claimed that an invasion would take place on several dates. Well, those dates have come and gone, and we've seen nothing of the sort. Yet if you listen to the news, you would think World War III was about to break out. Well, is it? Let's try and answer that question. Why exactly are there tensions between Russia and Ukraine? What are Russia's security concerns with NATO expansion, and are they legitimate? Is Putin really the malfeasant the West claims he is? Why is the United States backing Ukraine? What does it stand to gain? And does this crisis perhaps have more to do with Germany and Nord Stream 2 than it does with Ukraine and the Donbass region? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. We've been hearing for several months now that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is imminent. The media keeps saying that there are 100,000 Russian troops on Ukraine's border, meaning the Russian troops are in Russia. There's constant reports of shelling back and forth. And just the other day, the Russians evacuated civilians from Donetsk. But this media frenzy about an impending Russian invasion is really something. No one loves war more than the corporate media. And just to give you an idea how ridiculous it is, here are some of the claims that they make. First, they said that Putin will invade Ukraine on February 16th. They even had a date. And then they said it's February 16th at 3 a.m. And then on the evening before the supposed invasion, when Russia actually began withdrawing troops from its border with Ukraine, despite this, the lies continued. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan claimed that a Russian invasion was imminent.
And an invasion could begin, a major military action could begin by Russia in Ukraine any day now.
U.S. President Joe Biden said that he is sure that Putin has made the decision to invade.
And do you have any indication about whether President Putin has made a decision on whether to invade? Do you feel confident that he hasn't made that decision already?
As of this moment, I'm convinced he's made the decision. We have reason to believe that.
U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken even went to the United Nations Security Council to give a speech and warn the world of this impending Russian invasion. Even Blinken himself, he knew that it's not the best look to be sitting in the exact same seat as Colin Powell was 19 years ago, lying to the world to start a war in Iraq.
Some have called into question our information, recalling previous instances where intelligence ultimately did not bear out.
The U.S. says it suspects Russia will stage a false flag attack at some point in order to justify an invasion. Russia also says the same thing about Ukraine, and it looks like that might have happened. On February 17th, there was a report that a Ukrainian kindergarten had been shelled in Stanitsa Luhanska. While the Western media are saying that it was Russian-backed separatists, let's take a closer look at the photographs. Now, we can see a hole in the wall, which was apparently caused by a shell. But if you look to the left, the windows are intact. All the glass is still there. And if we look inside the classroom, there are still footballs on the shelf right next to the hole. So let me get this straight. This shell was so powerful, it was able to make a hole in the wall, but the glass right next to it is unshattered. You know, I'm not a physicist, but I have felt a blast before. And the first thing to go are the windows. So something looks fishy. And nevertheless, regardless of whether this was a Ukrainian or a Russian false flag, this entire crisis is manufactured. Now, many in the West, they make the argument that Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine in 2014 and annexed Crimea, and therefore he'll do it again. He's a hazard, he's a danger, and he poses a risk. Well, let's look at 2014 and what happened between Russia and Ukraine. I want to bring on Alexander McKay. He's the co-host of the Red Star Radio, a podcast that gives a Marxist perspective on economics, political issues, finance, and history. Alex, thank you for coming on the program. We really appreciate having you. What do you say to people who have legitimate concerns about Russia, who say that, well, Russia annexed Crimea, Putin just expelled the deputy U.S. ambassador, Russia says it's withdrawing troops from its border with Ukraine, but then the U.S. and NATO can't verify that. So, you know, who are we to believe? And what you make of what happened in 2014? What actually happened in 2014? And tell us perhaps how it relates to the current situation.
That was, a culmination of a process that had gone on since Ukrainian independence, which was that the Ukrainian oligarchy was unable to actually build a real nation, a solid nation, following the dissolution of the USSR, which, by the way, most Ukrainians voted against the dissolution of the USSR in a referendum back in 91, but that's background, really. But we get to this point because there was not just the coup in 2014, there was an attempted Orange Revolution 10 years before, which the US was heavily involved in, one of the first color revolutions that they were running. The US has been constantly intervening in Ukraine, as they did in Georgia before the 2008 war there, in order to absolutely make sure that they maintain influence over these former Soviet republics and that the Russian influence is minimized or pushed out entirely. And because of the Ukrainian oligarchy being so economically and politically weak, they have been sandwiched between the US, the Europeans on supposedly one side, and then the Russian influence on the other. And this has played out over and over again to the point where in 2014, you had Yanukovych, the elected president, was looking to get out of the severe economic difficulties which Ukraine had incurred after the crash in 2008 by trying to sign a deal with the EU, which was strongly encouraged by Washington. But as with all of the EU's deals, it was so onerous with regard to the economic conditions that it would impose on Ukraine that even Yanukovych, who was a very corrupt man, but he was the elected president, balked at it and felt he would be unable to carry out the cuts in living standards for ordinary Ukrainians demanded by the EU without facing significant instability. So he flips and signs a deal with Russia because Putin offered slightly better terms to him. And then, of course, then you get the reaction, which was a combination of many Ukrainians feeling entirely legitimately aggrieved that their nation was in this mess, and it was run by a very corrupt elite. But that movement was captured by an organized group of extreme nationalists, hardcore right-wing, semi-fascist elements. They were able to seize control of it. And when Yanukovych fled, following an attempt at a negotiated deal that was sponsored by Putin, that then collapsed because partly because the US, through people like the late Senator John McCain, Victoria Nuland, and various other operatives, were encouraging these far-right forces to keep going further and demanding more, taking more violent action in the street. And so this is how we got to the mess that we're in.
We heard that Russia would be invading Ukraine on February 16th. The Sun even had a date and a time for us. They said 1 a.m. GMT on February 16th. Well, that has come and gone. No invasion. So what do you make of this whole, mainstream media hyping up this war? And now they're pushing the date back. They're saying it's going to be February 20th and so on.
Well, I think the shock that I felt, I'm sure you did as well, that a Murdoch paper would make an unreliable prediction. Who knew that was coming? But more seriously, the attempt at hyping this up over and over again, the attempt at essentially creating almost a synthetic war out of nothing, just shows you really that those involved in it, the US and the British governments principally, have chosen to make this a way of escaping their quite prodigious internal problems, I would say. What we have is obviously an ongoing situation in Ukraine that was at least in part caused by the US and British investment in a coup there in 2014. It's rumbled on ever since then with various attempts to resolve it through the Minsk Accords not working out because of the internal problems in Ukraine. And now we've come back to this idea of the Russians launching an imminent invasion. It's been imminent since about October last year. And I think the principal reason why the US and the British keep returning to this and keep trying to amp this up is because it is a way for two embattled leaders, our prime minister and the US president, who are deeply unpopular, involved in all kinds of internal crises and scandals, to try and escape that, to try and reunify support around themselves. Then below that, you have all manner of motivations within the US, what's referred to the military-industrial complex, the intelligence agencies, and various other neoconservative freaks that hang around the Pentagon and the associated think tanks, who are just desperate to avenge themselves on Russia somehow, anyhow they can, and carry out some kind of long-cherished, insane dream that they're going to somehow restore Russia to the more weakened and chaotic state that it was in the 1990s.
You recently wrote on Twitter that, quote, in reality, the German ruling class have no interest in a war with Russia whatsoever, and this is just a desperate papering over the cracks in NATO. What do France and Germany actually want? Because we saw both the French president, Emmanuel Macron, and the German chancellor, Olaf Scholz, meeting with Putin, engaging in diplomacy, in dialogue. You know, Germany didn't seem too keen on sending Ukraine any weapons like the UK and the US. Why do you think they're acting differently from the US and the rest of Europe? Is there a rift, perhaps, in the NATO alliance?
Oh, yes. There's been a rift that's been developing, really, since Germany was reunited, which is that, and this is why it's part of the reason why our former Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, got into trouble and ultimately had to resign, because she was so opposed to German reunification, because she saw from the British ruling class's perspective that a reunited Germany would be too big and too powerful economically to be subjugated and controlled by Britain or the United States. And also, and this is what has happened certainly economically through EU membership, Germany has come to be the absolutely dominant economic player within Europe. Look at the huge benefits they've gained from Euro membership, for instance. Look at what they were able to do to Greece, for instance. And this contradiction lies in the problems that NATO is having, which is that the American position in Europe was dependent upon a divided Germany and all the nations of Europe being too weakened after World War II to essentially stand on their own. That's no longer the case. We no longer have the USSR there posing the threat that it used to capitalism. And so, therefore, all the tensions have erupted again. The Germans have a very extensive trading relationship with Russia that is very profitable for them. They've got the other question of, like, their own energy policy is now dependent upon getting gas from Russia. They can't have that compromised. Yeah. And so, therefore, the French and the Germans don't have an interest in some kind of war in the east of Europe. The problem for the French is that they are now dependent upon a relationship with the Americans militarily in sub-Saharan Africa. But at the same time, they don't want a war in Europe. They are stuck because of Macron and his predecessor's policy of trying to retain control over former French colonies like Mali, where they've just been told to get out of. And they're now reliant on the American AFRICOM, America's colonial military operation in sub-Saharan Africa, to retain their influence there. That's a contradiction for them. The Germans can't get out from under, or don't want to get out from under, American military hegemony. But at the same time, they have very extensive trading ties they want to protect, not just with Russia, but also with China. So you've got all these tensions playing out. And in many ways, like, the Americans and the British are desperately trying to paper over these cracks by saying, no, everything's fine, we're all united. But I'll bet, I don't know, but I'll bet that one of the things Macron and Scholz were saying to Putin was, we don't want this, you know, we don't want our relationship threatened, but we have to go along with the, you know, the insane elderly relative in the White House.
Some speculate that this crisis is not really about Ukraine, but in fact about the relationship between Russia and Germany, about Nord Stream 2, the gas pipeline that they've just finished building between Russia and Germany. What do you make of that?
Well, certainly there's a big lobby group within Washington, and certainly one within London, that didn't want to see Nord Stream 2 completed, that didn't want to see that trading relationship enhanced even further. They've largely failed because the pipeline itself has actually reached completion. The Germans are just holding up finalization of it through some sort of bureaucratic creation. This is another attempt to try and stymie a natural trading relationship, which it is natural that the United Germany and Russia have this economic relationship, and it's only going to develop further because these are two big potential markets for each other. And again, this is what I would call an undoubted contradiction of capitalism playing itself out in real time. Like, you have the impulse for the Germans to trade and make money in Russia, and for the Russians to do likewise. But then you have on top of that, imperialism's concern, US imperialism's concern to try and retain control. And these two things are running into each other, and Ukraine is part of the process of that playing itself out to a conclusion, which, well, we don't know yet, but is most likely to be the further diminishing of U.S. power, I would argue, rather than its enhancement.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
You know, there are many things that the media are not telling you about Ukraine. The first is NATO expansion. NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is a military alliance that was created right at the start of the Cold War back in 1949 with the aim of containing the Soviet Union. However, the Soviet Union ceased to exist in 1991. And if NATO's entire purpose was to counter the Soviets, then why does it still exist? It doesn't serve any actual purpose. The only things we've seen NATO do in recent times are things like destroying Libya, Syria, and others. And so when the Soviet Union collapsed, the Russians were concerned that NATO would continue expanding eastwards and eventually surround them with military bases. They made this clear to the West, and there was an understanding that NATO would not expand any further. Obviously, that promise has been broken. Since 1990, 14 countries have joined NATO. Russia is now surrounded not by just one NATO member, but five NATO members. I mean, come on, does anyone think that the United States would accept one enemy on its borders, never mind five? Do you think that 6% or 16% would make a difference to Washington? Of course not. The United States would lose it if one of its neighboring countries joined a military alliance with Russia. Let me give you a real-world example. In 1961, the United States tried to overthrow the Castro government in Cuba, in what is known as the Bay of Pigs. After this attempted coup, the Cubans asked the Soviets to place nuclear missiles in Cuba as a deterrent. And when the Americans realized what was happening in 1962, this caused such an outrage, such a crisis, that it's still talked about to this day. People still learn about it in school and university. The Cuban Missile Crisis is one of the most important moments in the entire Cold War. And why? Because the U.S. felt threatened by foreign weapons on its doorstep. So if it's not okay for Russia to place weapons on the U.S. border, why is it okay for the U.S. to place weapons on Russia's border? How would Americans feel in Russia's shoes? In December 2021, Russia issued a basic list of demands in order to calm the situation. Russia wants NATO to stop deploying troops near its borders and return to their pre-expansion positions in 1997. Russia also asked that Ukraine not be allowed to join NATO. But of course, Russia's legitimate security concerns are dismissed as non-starters. And then the West says that Russia refuses to engage in diplomacy. The thing is, though, this whole situation isn't just about Ukraine. It is also about Germany. The Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline between Russia and Germany was just recently completed in September 2021. You might recall Biden saying that the U.S. will no longer oppose it. Well, that's not entirely true. Take a look at what Biden just said a few days ago when he was giving a press conference right alongside German Chancellor Olaf Scholz.
The first question first. If Germany, if Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again, then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
How will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control?
We will, I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
So Joe Biden, the U.S. president, is standing right there next to the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, and speaking on his behalf, speaking for Germany. I mean, that is not only extremely disrespectful, but it's so telling. He's just straight up admitting to you who's really running the show. Now, Russia is already Europe's biggest supplier of gas, with around 40% of the market share. The completion of Nord Stream 2, of this pipeline, is so significant because it provides Europe with cheap, inexpensive gas while also boosting Russia's economy and prestige. It strengthens ties between Russia and Germany, and that is the last thing the U.S. wants. Remember, half the Cold War took place in Germany. Germany still has roughly 38,000 U.S. troops stationed there. And in order to justify NATO's existence and NATO's presence, the U.S. needs to sell this idea that Russia is aggressive, out of control, and must be contained. The U.S. needs to do this so it can justify having all these bases and tens of thousands of troops all over Europe. The United States has just sent 5,000 troops to Ukraine, along with a $200 million package of weapons in December 2021. But that's not all. Another thing the media aren't telling you is who the U.S. is supporting in Ukraine. The United States is supporting actual neo-Nazis, like the Azov Battalion. Last week, the Western media tried to pull off this propaganda stunt of showing a Ukrainian grandmother on the ground with a Kalashnikov learning to shoot in case the big bad Russians invade. Not only is this extremely tacky and cheap, but look at the arm patch on the guy who's teaching her to shoot. That symbol is called a Wolfsangel. It's a symbol used by a Nazi division in World War II, specifically the 2nd SS Panzer Division, Das Reich. This is the same division which committed the infamous massacre in the French village of Oradour. Al Jazeera did a segment on the neo-Nazi Freikorps in Ukraine, which is another one of these neo-Nazi militias. And pay attention, When they asked one of the members what their political ideology is, they refused to answer. I wonder why.
When you say they are more ideologically closer to you, can you tell me what you mean by that? How? What do you believe in ideologically?
Can we pause that?
Let me repeat that so there's no mistake. Yes, the United States is funding neo-Nazi militias in Ukraine. And then they talk about Russia being a threat. I mean, this is scandalous. You know, when they say Russia is threatening Ukraine, is that really true, or is it Ukraine and NATO threatening Russia? How would the Americans feel if Russia surrounded the United States with bases, or if Canada and Mexico joined a military alliance with Russia? How is it that Russia moving Russian troops inside Russia is a threatening buildup of troops, but Britain and America sending weapons to Ukraine, sending troops to Ukraine, with talk of NATO membership, that's not threatening to Russia? This double standard and hypocrisy, I mean, it couldn't be more obvious. And of course, if you dare to open your mouth and say that, hey, you know, Russia's security concerns might actually be legitimate, then you're reduced to a Putin puppet or a Kremlin asset by neoliberals and neocons alike. That's what they do when they want to silence dissent, they want to silence criticism. That's their go-to tool. Just call someone a Russian asset. And so we really get to see again how ridiculous the corporate Western media is, how they march in lockstep with the CIA in complete conformity. Just like with Iraq, Libya, Syria, Vietnam, they take anything the CIA tells them and report it as fact. There's no scrutiny whatsoever. You know, hardly anyone pauses for a second to ask, hey, is this true? Do you have anything to back this claim up? The corporate media is truly a mouthpiece of the state and the arms dealers. And you know, it's very easy to buy into Western propaganda. There's nothing special about that. There's nothing tough about going along with the lies in the mainstream. However, what does take some effort is to look past the propaganda and to make a slight effort to try and understand a simple concept, that agreements should be respected, and Russia, just like the United States, does not want adversarial troops, nukes, and missiles on its borders. It's really not that complicated. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.com. www.ukrainepodcast.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., Republican leaders are facing fresh demands to expel the Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene after she spoke at a conference of white nationalists. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist David Smith. The piece is titled Calls to Expel Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene After Speech at White Nationalist Event. In the United States, Republican leaders are facing fresh demands to expel the Georgia Congresswoman, Marjorie Taylor Greene, after she spoke at a conference of white nationalists. The event in Orlando, Florida, on Friday night, 25th of February, was organized by the far-right extremist Nick Fuentes, who told attendees, "Now they're going on about Russia and Vladimir Putin is Hitler. They say that's not a good thing." He burst into laughter and, as he added, "I shouldn't have said that." Nick Fuentes, recently subpoenaed for his involvement in the 6th of January 2021 insurrection, proudly introduced Marjorie Taylor Greene at the 3rd Annual America First Political Action Conference, or AFPAC. The Georgia congresswoman told the gathering they were cancelled Americans who had a responsibility to stop the Democrats, who are the Communist Party of the United States of America, Huffington Post reported. Her patronage of the America First Political Action Conference, AFPAC, where the Arizona Congressman Paul Gosar also appeared via pre-recorded video, provoked sharp condemnation of party leaders for failing to discipline her. Liz Cheney, a member of the House Select Committee investigating the 6th of January riot, tweeted, "As Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene and Representative Paul Gosar speak at this white supremacist, anti-Semitic event, silenced by Republican Party leaders, is deafening and enabling. All Americans should renounce this garbage and reject this wing of the GOP now." The Democratic National Committee pointed out that Kevin McCarthy, the Republican minority leader in the House, has consistently failed to take action against Marjorie Taylor Greene. Amar Moussa, spokesperson for the Democratic National Committee, said, "In any other world, Green speaking at a white supremacist conference would warrant expulsion from the caucus, to say nothing of her advocacy for violence and consistent anti-Semitism is disgusting." Quite simply, the longer Kevin McCarthy gives Marjorie Taylor Greene an unfettered platform and promises to elevate her, the more complicit McCarthy is. On Saturday, Marjorie Taylor Greene sought to defend her appearance at AFPAC. She told CBS News, "I went to talk to them about America's first policies, and I talked to them about what's important for our country going forward." Asked if she endorses Nick Fuentes' views, Marjorie Taylor Greene claimed, "I don't know what his views are." Told that he is a white nationalist, she said, "I do not endorse those views." Marjorie Taylor Greene gave the interview on the sidelines of the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, a separate event also in Orlando, Florida. She appeared on a panel just hours before former President Donald Trump was due to speak. The Congresswoman attacked Twitter for banning her and promoting Donald Trump's new social media site, Truth Social. She taunted Hillary Clinton, the former Democratic presidential nominee, and Anthony Fauci, infectious disease expert and chief medical advisor to President Joe Biden. "We have to hold Democrats accountable, everybody, right? Fire Fauci. We've got to investigate Hillary Clinton's campaign. Lock her up. Lock them all up." With that, Marjorie Taylor Greene laughed and the audience burst into applause. Greene has a history of anti-Semitic and incendiary comments that include blaming California's wildfires on Jewish space lasers, suggesting Muslims do not belong in government, and warning that Gazpacho police patrol the U.S. Capitol. By Gazpacho police, she presumably meant Gestapo police. But the timing of her AFPAC speech could hardly have been more provocative. Fred Wellman, a political consultant and Iraq War veteran, commented on Twitter, "This is where Marjorie Taylor Greene spent her evening, laughing about comparisons to Hitler being bad. This is who she is. You know, they burnt crosses in Martin Luther King's yard just 62 years ago. It's time for Georgia to put this trash out forever." The Republican Jewish Coalition joined the condemnation. "It's appalling and outrageous that a member of Congress would share a platform with an individual who has actively spread anti-Semitic bile, mocked the Holocaust, and promoted dangerous conspiracy theories," the group said in a statement. The Republican Jewish Coalition added, "This has absolutely no place within the Republican Party."
Welcome back to Aperture. We witnessed the spectacular and awe-inspiring natural beauty of the Kaluts, or Yardangs, in the western part of Dashtalut in Iran. Rising up to 80 meters, these streamlined ridges have been carved by the wind out of the clay and sand lining the desert floor, creating a magnificent array of high-rising sculptures and lying parallel to the prevailing winds. The Yardangs are some of the world's most prominent. Stay with us as we follow Javad Gharayi, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, as he introduces more of Iran's desert wonders to us.
Early the next morning, I was still sleepy and tired, but some of the most beautiful natural views revealed themselves in the moments before sunrise. The cold and the dark couldn't stop me from exploring the natural beauties near my camp. The early hours of morning in the natural world fills you with energy. Filled to the brim with that energy that emanates from the peace and tranquility bestowed upon this land by God Almighty, I started my day that promised to be a good one. I spent 3 hours exploring the areas around my tent, taking beautiful photos of the unmatched scenery of the Kaluts, a precious gift by Mother Nature to those who appreciate her.
Thank you.
It was time for me to leave the imaginary city of Kalutz, a city with great potential for becoming a destination for responsible tourists and nature travelers. The most beautiful natural scenes should either be visited in the early hours of morning or sometime around sundown. I got up at 6 o'clock this morning and was able to take spectacular snaps of the natural beauties around here with this very camera. I have to say, I love Iran with all my being because of its very rich culture and its remarkably diverse natural beauties. It's time to go now. I have to pack up. I gotta put my tent back into my backpack and head out for the Kalutz again. This is my last day here. I can't stay here much longer because I'm running out of food and water. Not only the Kalutz, but the entire vast Lut region are considered as an invaluable natural museum in the world. All by itself, the Lut Desert is home to a world of numerous beauties, the like of which are scattered in different places across our planet. Without a doubt, it's among the most beautiful deserts on Earth. The Yalon Mega Dunes with their rare views, the Kalutz, the star-shaped dunes, the beautiful valleys in the heart of Lut, the hottest part of Dashtelut, which is Gandum Beryan, a large plateau covered in dark lava, the unique vegetation, including small trees named Saxols, the Martian or miniature mountains on the fringes of Lut, the central hole, the Dolphin Valley comprised of rock formations eroded by wind, Dashtekashk, and the plant and animal species endemic to Lut. Add to all that the villages with their unique desert architecture, people whose cultures go back 6,000 years. My GPS is telling me I've walked around 36 kilometers through the Kalutz. This is nearly the end of my trek into the Kalutz. Another very beautiful feature of the Kalutz of Kerman, in other words, the Kalutz of Shahdad, is the Nepka Forest Park. These very beautiful plants you see behind me here are in fact the trees that have formed this Nepka Forest Park. Only two species, salt cedars and saxols, which have grown here and created this beautiful and unique landscape. This area obviously looks different from others. The Nepka's Forest Park forms the vegetation on the fringe of the Kalut area. But this green patch fades away as you move from the cold mountains of Sirj to the hot, dry Kalutz. And in the heart of the Kalutz, there is hardly any vegetation at all. But Mother Nature has created a matchless forest in the area between the Sirj Mountains and the Kalutz. This strange land formation I'm standing next to is not your simple hill. It is the world's biggest natural vase known as the Nepka. This phenomenon is called Nepka in the African Sahara, Shur Moro in the central areas of Iran, and Talagaz by those living on the eastern and southeastern plains of Iran. When sandstorms blow past the vegetation in this area, they leave behind some of the dirt and sand at the foot of these plants. When the wind blows, some of the sand and dirt is trapped in the trees and crashes to the ground, creating a mound over time. In order to survive, the trees use their long roots to absorb water and other nutrients buried underground. The dirt around the shrubs and trees contain more moisture. This relative moisture keeps the sand and earth in place around the plant. Of course, that leads to a portion of the trunk, branches, and leaves being buried, which in turn contributes to the solidification of the sand near the plant. Every natural NEPCA vase is named according to the species it hosts. The NEPCAs are called Talagaz or Talitar by the locals in this region. Another unique feature of Lute are these same NEPCAs. They are the tallest natural vases in the world. The NEPCAs of this kind have been seen in Africa too, but the ones in Africa are barely 3 meters tall. At their tallest, the NEPCAs in Iran are 10 meters tall. Normally, NEPCAs grow on flat surfaces. They best grow on moist land. The shape of the NEPCA depends on the size, density, and growth rate of the host plant. In this NEPCA forest, the dominant species is the salt cedar. My goodness, it looks more like a miracle. Just look how God instilled the hope for life in these salt cedars and saxols. When they're just small seedlings, winds dump massive amounts of sand onto them. But driven by their strong will to live, they continue to grow in order to survive. The battle between the wind and sand on one hand and these trees on the other has been going on forever. It's been around for millions of years. But what is really very important is that hope keeps everything and everyone alive. And these trees, because of their intrinsic sense of hope, the will for life, put their roots down and stand tall. They continue to grow as a means of survival. It's going to become stormy very soon. Desert storms are very dangerous. So what you need to do is find shelter somewhere or leave that area immediately. Fortunately, I'm very close to my next destination, and I think I'm not going to run into any trouble. But I have to get going immediately, or I'm going to get sand and dirt all over my body and stuff. My camera crew and I were taken off guard by the sudden change of weather and the subsequent sandstorm. One of the biggest powers of nature in a desert is the ability of sand and dust to penetrate each and every orifice during a storm, and our equipment was no exception. Sandstorms are among the biggest dangers of a desert. In some cases, such storms continue to blow for days and can cost nature travelers their lives. But there are other dangers lurking in other parts of this vast plain. Therefore, the best way to ensure a safe trip to Lute is to make the necessary arrangements with the relevant authorities in Kerman province and the city of Shahdad. From Shahdad, I had to walk around 250 kilometers to the west of the province, to a place only 15 kilometers away from Rafsanjan. Kerman is a province with limited water resources. Many of the deep wells in the province have dried up. But deep in the heart of Rafsanjan's crisis-hit nature, there is a canyon that sparkles like a diamond. You might be thinking this isn't Iran, that I'm speaking to you from another country. But you're wrong. This is our beloved Iran, and I'm now standing atop a scary deep canyon, the Raga Grand Canyon of Rafsanjan. Valleys and canyons are strange yet beautiful natural phenomena. and they become even more beautiful if their emergence is not the result of orogeny. Rather, if it's the result of thousands or millions of years of erosion by wind, sand, and water of flat plains. Raga Grand Canyon is one such ravine, a peerless, pristine valley in Kerman Province. I was amazed at the view of the canyon from above. The pointed cones, the big and small columns carved out by erosion, the arcs, the partitions and wall-like strips were only a few of all the beautiful features of this canyon. Raga is around 20 kilometers long. Its width varies between 3 and 100 kilometers, and in some places it is around 80 meters deep. Walking on top of it could have been very dangerous. My goodness, it's really scary, but it's magnificent at the same time. At this point, I think it's around 70 meters deep from where I'm standing. If I fall into it, there will be nothing left of me. It's dangerous to be here because the earth here is very soft and can slide at any moment. So you'll have to keep a safe distance while walking along these beautiful walls. It's ruggedly beautiful indeed. You can get the most beautiful view of the canyon from up here, but every side of it offers its own unique beauty. What I'm really happy about is the fact that there is no construction work happening anywhere in a 20-kilometer radius. There are no roads. That's why this ravine has maintained its pristine status, and of course, the area around it too. My hope is that we can preserve this untouched ravine and its surroundings the way they are and leave them to the next generation, and they to the generation that comes after them, just like the way it looks now. I hope so. The canyon's geomorphology and its pristine environs made for beautiful scenery, and that had provided a good habitat for certain species of animals in and around it. This region and this gorge are so intact, they have become home to various species of birds, such as eagles that have built their nests in recesses high on the walls where they feel safe. I'm very excited and counting every minute for the walk on the bed of the canyon, but the best time to do it would be tomorrow because I don't have enough time for it today. Raga Canyon is a good destination for geologists and nature travelers venturing into the Lute. The vegetation, such as salt cedar trees in some parts of the canyon, made the canyon even more beautiful. From the bottom up, ravines look just as beautiful. I walked along much of Raga Canyon from above and captured many beautiful views of it, but it was now time to go down to the bottom of it. This part of the wall is solid. It's hard to walk on. It's very steep too, as you can see. You have to take a lot of care going down. My God, yes! At the bottom, the canyon was beautiful and scary. I kept thinking its walls were going to come crashing down any minute. Walking at the foot of those majestic walls, I felt how little and weak I was compared to the canyon and to its creator. On one hand, the beautiful long natural statues and on the other, the tunnel-shaped arcs carved into the walls were all astonishing. Statues chiseled